Welcome, everyone, to episode 21 of Debating Doctor Who. I'm Alistair Wilkins.
I'm Caroline Sita, and I'm excited that we can throw away our fake IDs and properly drink as a 21-episode-old podcast.
That was well thought out. That was well executed, and I liked it. All right, so we got. I suspect we're going to have a lot to talk about today, because we have three episodes. We have the latest episode, Kill the Moon, which it's a bit of a controversial one. So we'll probably have some stuff to discuss there. And then in the second half, we're going to be looking at a pair of episodes where the Doctor faces some difficult moral dilemmas from the Season 1 episode, Boomtown. Again, back to the Ninth Doctor. I'm happy to be talking about the Ninth Doctor in Caroline. It feels like a while since we've talked about
it. It really does. I feel like we go through little, we kind of get stuck in a period where we'll do a lot of like Season 7 and then a lot of Season 4. And then
yeah,
it's nice to get some diversity in there.
And there, I mean, to be fair, there is not a ton of Ninth Doctor to talk about. But anyway,
we got to space him out.
I am glad to see him again. And then we'll be looking at a Series 6 episode, The Girl Who Waited, with the 11th Doctor, Amy, and Rory. So we've got all that to look forward to. But first, Caroline, I believe it's that time again.
Celebration. Okay.
I think that was your best one, by the way.
Thanks. I was really geared up because I feel like the past couple I've forgotten until the last second.
You did.
This time,
I noticed.
Ready to go.
I didn't want to say anything at the time, but you totally did. But well done this time.
Well, thank you. And also thanks to our new Danielle Fan Email of the Week award winner, Joe S., who wrote us this lovely email. He says, "Hi, Caroline and Alistair. Just listening to your podcast for the first time today. Since you mentioned Danny's improbable flip, have you seen the animated GIF comparing the Doctor's fear is a superpower talk to Rupert in Listen to Danny's flip? The running and jumping could easily be coincidence, but showing the flip in slow motion makes it seem like a planned parallel. I look forward to next week's podcast as I'm alternating between dreading and eagerly awaiting Kill the Moon. Cheers, Joe." And Joe sent us the link to a fun little GIF/GIF set from Tumblr, where, as he mentioned, it is comparing the Doctor talking to Rupert in Listen, where he's saying, "Right now you could run faster and you could fight harder. You can jump higher than ever in your life. And you are so alert, it's like you can slow down time." And that's compared to, of course, Danny's slow motion front flip from The Caretaker. So we'll put a link to that in our post. And thank you so much, Joe, for getting in touch with us.
I think it's a cool idea. That's a deep cut, even for Moffat era connections, I have to say, but it is a cool comparison. I'm not necessarily convinced that was the authorial intent in The Caretaker, but it was definitely a cool connection to make.
I'm not either convinced it was intentional, but I do think Tumblr is particularly good at finding kind of parallels, intentional or not, in these episodes and comparing them. So I actually think that it's always cool to see stuff like this and how it can at least thematically link if it's not, you know, actually a plot point.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I will say, and I agree with you, I think that there are some great things to Tumblr, maybe some less great things, but I think one of the great things, you're right, is it is cool to have this sort of platform where you can do all these visual comparisons very effectively. Because I don't think that would work, like, describing it. And hence why it's great that we're discussing this on a podcast, I suppose. I think that one of the things I mentioned in my review of the most recent episode is, like, the thing about Doctor Who is that it always will support really deep readings, sometimes deeper than perhaps is like the intent, but I think that that's kind of what's cool about the premise, is that it's just so deep and lends itself to just taking really crazy deep dives, just sort of by the nature of it. So anyway, so that was a cool one, I thought.
Yeah, and if you want to send us a deep dive or really anything, you can send us an email at debatingdoctorwho@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, we're @DW, or on Tumblr. We do have a Tumblr. We don't reblog a lot of GIFs, but if you guys demand it, we can certainly start doing that. We are debatingdoctorwho.tumblr.com. So find us any of those places.
I'd love to be sent goofy questions. So I want to answer some fun questions. So that's what I'm asking to you Twitterers and you Tumblrers out there and you emailers, whatever. Send us some weird Who hypotheticals. Let's see where we can go with this.
I'm super into that as well. Well, it's a big week this week for Doctor Who alum. We had two new American shows that premiered starring very recent graduates of the Who universe. Karen Gillan's Selfie show premiered on Tuesday. We actually talked about the pilot already in episode 15 of Debating Doctor Who, so go there for our thoughts. The other big premiere was David Tennant commandeering American TV in his new show Grace Point, which is a very literal remake of a series he recently started in England called Broadchurch, show run by the same person, Chris Chibnall, who is also a regular Doctor Who writer. Aside from David Tennant, who's doing an American accent in this, everybody else is a new cast, although in a really odd move, all the characters have the same names as their British counterparts, except for David Tennant's character, where they just arbitrarily switched his name. Don't ask me why. That's just the thing that happened. I got a chance to watch this episode. Alistair, I know that you haven't had time yet, so hopefully we can...
Well, to be fair, Caroline, I've watched the first episode of Broadchurch, so I feel I have seen the first episode of Grace Point.
Yeah, that's pretty fair. This Grace Point episode is very famously a shot-for-shot remake of the Broadchurch premiere. It sounds like they're literally adapting this... if not shot for shot the whole season, at least in these first couple of episodes. They've promised that because it's a murder mystery, they've promised that the ultimate killer will be different than in the British show. But up until then, it sounds like things are going to be very similar, which I have to say, having watched both and having been a huge fan of Broadchurch, Grace Point does not really hold up as well in my estimation. It's actually remarkable how something can be, you know, shot for shot the same, and yet there's something about the essence or the tone that's missing. I think when you compare the two directly, Broadchurch is obviously superior. It's just something about that British tone and that sort of subdued, muted, somber energy that works so well for what is kind of like a long-term murder mystery that takes place in a small town where a young boy is killed, and it's the kind of place where this thing never happens. And Grace Point, there's definitely things to like. I think if you're not familiar with Broadchurch, it's certainly worth checking out because, you know, we want to support David Tennant in America, I guess. But I have to say, if you're only going to watch one of them, I would say make it Broadchurch.
Now, Caroline, my understanding, really just from looking at the cast list and knowing what the actors involved look like, is most of the casting decisions here are made to be pretty close parallels to the original people. Is that fair?
Yeah, it does seem like that. I think the biggest shift here is Anna Gunn as the co-lead, replacing Olivia Colman from the British show.
That's what I wanted to ask, because mm-hmm. Anna Gunn seems like a really different actor's energy and presence from Olivia Colman.
Yeah, I think she is. And that could end up being interesting. I think we haven't quite seen enough of her yet to see how this different interpretation will play out. Olivia Colman played the character as a very kind of chipper and kind and empathetic woman, which was such a fascinating juxtaposition to David Tennant's character, who was like the grumpiest grump that ever lived.
And that's not really Anna Gunn. Like strike me as what she does.
I think it's smart that she's not trying for that. It doesn't feel like she's putting on the chipperness. There's still that kind of like softer edge to her character. Certainly she's very maternal, and the kind of like heart of the story is that he's going about this with a very kind of professional air, and she's going about this as someone who lives in this town. And in fact, the boy that was murdered is best friends with her son. So there's like an emotional element to her. She's definitely not quite as warm as Olivia Colman. So it's kind of hard to say where they'll go with that. I would say it works okay in the Grace Point premiere, but again, like, Colman's performance was, to me, the standout performance of Broadchurch, so it's always going to be hard to compare someone, you know, doing something different from a version that you liked so much.
Well, I think what we'll do is we're going to let a few more Grace Point episodes and a few more Selfie episodes accumulate, and then maybe once this season of Doctor Who has wrapped up, which is, I can't believe I'm saying this, but only like 5 weeks away, we will maybe then take a look at where those seasons are up to, because that'll be – actually, most of Grace Point will be done by that point, and then Selfie, assuming it doesn't sort of have a disastrous run in the ratings, will be hopefully, I guess, about a third of the way through its season by that point, depending whether it's taking weeks off. So I think that'll be our plan for those two shows, that we will take a check back in on them. But so for now, I think if you're doing one, probably Selfie is the more interesting one at the moment mm-hmm. than Grace Point. Although, admittedly, like, unless you literally choose things based on the presence of a Who alum, these are not shows with obvious overlaps in intended audience.
Very different shows.
Very different. But you know, let's talk about sort of the ultimate show for Doctor Who alums. That's Doctor Who. So let's talk about this week's episode.
Yes. And always we will be discussing spoilers. So turn us off if you haven't watched the episode yet, and do check out, Alistair's very thoughtful review of Kill the Moon over on the AV Club, which as always is very helpful for me when I'm sort of putting my thoughts together after immediately watching these episodes. Alistair, I really liked Kill the Moon.
Yay! I'm very.
I feel like you. Maybe you're not, but I always feel like you're nervous to hear whether we're on differing opinions or something.
I am so nervous. And frankly, the fact that you've liked pretty much every episode this season, give or take what Time Heist, I think was the one that you were kind of on. Mm-hmm. But pretty. This has been a very. I thought there was a good description of someone on the AV Club comments comparing series 5 to series 8. Mm-hmm. Which is that series 5 may have gotten more right thus far, but series 8 has gotten less wrong than any other season so far. And I think that might be right, that I'm not sure it's soared as much yet, but I have to admit, with these last couple of episodes, I'm pretty excited where the season's going. So
it's been a really good run.
Yeah.
I think Kill the Moon suffers a little bit of what we talked about last week, which is this concept of fridge logic, where, you know, you might be watching something and everything, it all makes sense to you. An hour later, you're going to get a snack and you're like, wait a minute, what about that thing? And what about this thing? And all of a sudden you realize there's a ton of plot holes. That was really my experience with Kill the Moon. Watching it, I was super engrossed. Later, thinking about it myself, also scrolling kind of through other reviews and through a couple Tumblr posts, I was like, actually, there's a lot that doesn't make sense in here.
Primarily the science, because this is one of the worst episodes from a science perspective.
Yeah, the science
history.
Although that doesn't bother me as much.
It
like
does
the science
not
is really
me
dumb
either. Yeah,
but there's certain elements. I'll go ahead and just read one that I pulled up that
Please.
I really liked, because I have to say this is from one of my favorite people on Tumblr. They post a lot of Doctor Who, a lot of other stuff. The Tumblr account is Oodly Enough. Tumblr.com.
Man, that was a good one to get.
I know, a really good get.
That's a ground floor Doctor Who Tumblr name. Well done, Oodly Enough.
Yeah, she's been around forever. I think she's like a 23-year-old in Canada. I could be wrong, but I think that's her. I always enjoy your posts. This one, I have to say, I'll read it and then I'll tell you my reaction to it. So she said, talking specifically about like the moon egg, which is of course kind of the big reveal in this episode. It was uncomfortable to me how the episode seemed to say anyone who wanted to kill the moon egg was morally bankrupt, when really these people were just trying to save their planet and every single life on it. Not even just people, but like all the animals, plants, etc. Also, it felt like the only reason this alien life was valuable was because it was really big. Like if the episode had been, should we save all of planet Earth or this fertilized chicken egg? Literally no one would think twice about killing the stupid egg. You wouldn't. That's a ridiculous situation. But because it was a big egg, that was potentially the only one of its kind. And she adds, how would we possibly know that? Who laid this egg? We don't even know what's in there. There could be billions of moon eggs around the universe and you never noticed. Its life was apparently more valuable than that of every single creature on planet Earth. I read this post and could not stop laughing for like a good 10 minutes just in my room alone, because I think that is such a good parallel, saying should we, you know, because the ultimate question of Kill the Moon is should we sacrifice this one life to save a whole planet's worth of lives? And they're right. She's right that pointing out that because the moon egg is somehow mystical or unique, we put so much value on it, and because it's so big. But you're absolutely right. If the question was, should we save this chicken egg, or even should we save this egg, we don't know what's inside of it, but it fits in your hand, versus should we blow up all of planet Earth? Of course you're going to destroy the egg. And so maybe this kind of big moral question of Kill the Moon does not work quite as well when you start to kind of dissect it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'll just say, I know that there have been a lot of reactions to sort of the central, mm-hmm. to what people say is the central moral dilemma of the episode. And maybe we'll get into some more of that, you know, sort of, because this has been an episode that's provoked a ton of different reactions. But to me, I guess my feeling is that that is not the central moral dilemma of the episode. The central moral issue of the episode to me is how the Doctor treats Clara. And, mm-hmm. and like, to me, like, the whole moon egg thing is sort of a means to that end, because that sort of the, you know, because I think that you have to assume, unless that this Doctor is just outright psychopathic, which I don't think he is. Like, he left on the assumption that it'll probably be all right. Like, when he says at the end, oh, yeah, it'll probably, you know, I was pretty sure it was going to be fine. He's correct. And he wasn't, like, lying there. So, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where I think it is undercooked. Like, the exploration of, like, yeah, how are humans reacting? And, like, you know, the whole, like, you know, the lights turning out and so forth. I don't know whether they're depicting it as morally bankrupt so much as just, like, it's just a little underdeveloped.
Yeah. Well, and I think the problem that she is pointing out and that I had as well is, like, It's a little unclear how we're supposed to think about all of this, because it seems like the doctor is presenting a choice and asking them to, like, choose one of two equally valid options, but then later is like, actually, one was right and one was wrong, and this was a test, and you had to pick the right one. I think you're right. What the episode does so well is everything in the Clara-Doctor dynamic. Like, that I really agree with. I do think the stuff with the egg, like, it's confusing what we're supposed to think, because ultimately what happens is that, like, Earth votes. Like, we have a democratic system. Earth votes, and then Clara, like, becomes a dictator and does something else. And I don't think that's what the episode wants us to take away from it, yeah. Certainly. But, like, it is confusing, because are we condemning Earth for, you know, turning out all its lights? That in itself seems problematic, because a lot of places on Earth don't have lights. I don't know. There's,
well, by 2049,
these are not things that...
By 2049, you'd like to think that by 2049 the world has moved forward a little bit. I mean, I think that my take on that, because as I was watching it, one of the things that occurred to me as I was watching it, not even when I went to the fridge later, was, well, surely the various governments of the world would just decide and then shut off their power grids.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, it's not like literally every individual person is being entrusted to make their own decision and then turn off lights. Like, one of those things where if you had, like, you know, an extra 10 minutes, you could actually develop, like, the Earth side of the story. But I think what we're really supposed to take away from the Earth thing, and it's a relatively small part of the episode, but it's like that moment on the beach where the Doctor is sort of having history, like, rush through him, which is a really nicely acted moment by Peter Capaldi, by the way. Like, how I think he really sells the idea that the Doctor is literally feeling history at that point. But, like, it's just that humans who up to this point had been sort of paranoid and scared and worried and fearful and just looking out for themselves saw something incredible in space and felt that they had to go join it. And I think that it's more like a realignment of perspective as opposed to a condemnation. It's saying that this was the last moment where Earth was keeping its eyes shut to the wonders out there, and this is the moment where forever after its eyes are open.
I think you're absolutely right on that, in terms of that's what we're supposed to take away. And to an extent, that is what I did take away. But it does seem like the problem itself was so – I don't know. The problem was, like, should we sacrifice the, you know, the few to support the needs of the many? And then the episode was like, no, of course, never do that, because nothing bad could – like, in this situation, it seems like the best answer actually was blowing it up, and it was very foolhardy not to, and it was just kind of like a lucky happenstance that things worked out well. And so I guess that's kind of like – even though the end point, like the emotional end point worked, like I think the logical parts of it didn't work as well.
Well, I think that – I mean, I know the fact that I'm spluttering so much indicates that these are clearly valid points. You know, I'll say that I'm definitely, like, on the bell curve, like, on the very far end of how well this episode worked for me. Because, again, to me, the thing that was important about this episode is the Doctor and Clara, and, like, the other stuff I found interesting but not essential. So I think I'm sort of – I'm putting it against a lower sort of evidentiary standard than I would than if I felt like that was actually the most important part of the episode. I'll say that right now. But I think, to be honest, part of it is this is just kind of what Doctor Who is. Like, you know, Doctor Who as a show, this is the correct moral decision on Doctor Who. And yeah, it's one of those things where, well, it's like that old way that good old Craig Ferguson described it. You know, it's how do you describe it? It's like, you know, the triumph of, like, you know, science and
optimism
and yeah, over
cynicism.
Yeah, it's like Doctor Who's an optimistic show, and it's always going to make the optimistic choice. And I'm not saying that if you don't want to make the optimistic choice, don't watch Doctor Who. That's silly. But, like, I think that you just kind of have to understand this is not the kind of show that's going to go into those really dark places. And it is going to sometimes make those decisions that, you know, don't make as much sense, perhaps, but is in keeping with, I think, a larger moral philosophy to which Doctor Who subscribes. And that I'm, to be honest, glad that there's at least one show. And I think in a media world that still tends to be fairly dark and gritty by its nature, still kind of subscribes to this. But again, I'm not going to argue that this is a perfectly developed episode from either a scientific or a logical perspective. This is, to me, though, Kill the Moon is fundamentally a character piece, and that's where, to me, it's a triumph.
Well, let's talk about what does work, because I think, as I said, I like it, and on the whole, I do think that, you know, I feel like I say this all the time, but with these Who episodes, there's times where I think, you know, things don't work as well, you can see it, but it's just hard to be bothered by them because other things are so strong. And I think ultimately that is the case with Kill the Moon. I think the episode kind of breaks down into two, maybe three chunks. The first chunk is just kind of like a fun, suspenseful trip to the moon. I thought that was all actually really well done. I think I might have liked that even more than you did. It's basically them exploring this abandoned moon base. There's nothing super, you know, interesting going on, but the whole thing I thought was really well done. The suspense was good. The atmospherics were all good. I liked the addition of Courtney. Then you get about halfway through, the episode flips. It becomes, of course, about this big moral dilemma with the egg and should they blow it up. I did appreciate that this was very, without highlighting it too hard, it was, you know, three women that were making this decision. I thought that was really interesting because you always think of these big, you know, geopolitical decisions being made by male rulers. So I thought that was a really nice, subtle choice to make there. And then, of course, the final part of the episode is the confrontation between Clara and the doctor, which I think you and I both agree is the strongest part of this episode. And I kind of liked that. To me, it actually came a little bit out of left field. That was not where I thought this episode was going to end, because I think it ends on a happy ending. This isn't like the Girl Who Waited, where there does seem like there's a thing to get mad about, like there's been some sort of flaw in the plan. Kill the Moon actually ends, as we said, as well as it could. The dragon, alien, moon baby, whatever we're calling it, gets to go off into space. You know, Earth is saved. They get a new moon. They get to go and explore the stars. So the fact that Clara is so upset about this is such an interesting choice. And I think it's a really cool thing to show that you can, you know, things can work out well and they can still have been emotionally traumatizing to you. And it's so nice that the show lets her kind of condemn the doctor in a way I'm not sure anyone has done before, and in a way probably many people should have done before.
Yeah, there's really zero precedent for this on in the new series, certainly, and I don't really think it reminded me a little bit of how Tegan leaves the Fifth Doctor, which we can throw a link into that. I don't think we need to show it for this podcast, although we may circle back to it one of these days. But where basically she just says too many people have died, this isn't fun anymore. But it's a very, you know, it's a very minor note version of this, which is just, whoa, this is a blistering rebuke, I believe was the term I used in the review. And if I didn't, I should have, because, man, Clara fires with both barrels here. And I saw in the comments, there's a lot of people thought that Clara overreacted here. And that I think is insane, frankly. Or that I disagree with, perhaps, to be more civil about it. But, you know, and I think some people thought the doctor was correct in his decision, but no, I think the doctor is 100% wrong in how he acted, and I thought Clara was completely justified in where she was coming from.
That's interesting, and that's what I kind of got from your review as well, was that you were kind of seeing the flaws in the doctor kind of throughout the episode, which is not how I watched it, actually. I thought that this was a pretty, in a way, it was like a pretty standard adventure. The doctor leaving actually really reminded me of that part in the Silurian two-parter where he leaves Amy and the Silurians to sort of come up with a plan for Earth. He's like, you're the representatives of these two races. You can figure it out. And because there was a precedent for it, even though it is such a big act for him to leave Clara, it didn't feel like, whoa, this is a huge change. So I was kind of watching it all on board. What I really appreciated about the episode is that once Clara started making her arguments, I thought I could totally get on board with her point of view too. So while I didn't automatically, it's not that necessarily what the doctor did was so terrible, because maybe if he had done it to someone else, it would have been okay. But it was the fact that he didn't know her well enough to know that this was not how she should be treated. And that he was, you know, and she rightly points out, like, very kind of paternalistic about this and has not learned through traveling with her, like, what she needs as a companion, that it's kind of been this one-sided relationship where she gives him what he needs from her, but he is not giving that back to her. And it tied so well with the end of The Caretaker, where Danny talked about making sure the doctor didn't push her too far. And it was so nice to see that kind of dealt with so quickly here, and I think dealt with really effectively.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the other important thing, the word that Clara uses in that scene that I don't think that enough people have picked up on from just looking at the response. She mentions the doctor is her friend, and the doctor does not treat her like a friend here. And I don't think it's that Clara wanted the doctor to make a decision for her. I think she wanted his advice. She wanted his help. She wanted his thoughts. Like, it's just she wanted to solve it together. Like, even if, like, yes, ultimately, you know, he was going to force the humans to take responsibility, there's no reason why he has to literally jump ahead to when they've made the decision. And what I think she's realizing is he is treating her like he's a Time Lord and she's a human, or he's the officer and she's the soldier, to use Danny's metaphor from the caretaker. And so it's not a, you know, he is not treating her like a friend. And after all this time, how on earth are they not friends? You know, and I think that to me, that's the thing that really they key in to in a very powerful way in that final scene with Killmonger. That's what I really responded to, that it's that question of what is their relationship? And I think that Clara learns in the starkest possible terms, their relationship is not what she thought it was.
It's all about the Doctor having power all the time, and sometimes he wants to use that power, sometimes he doesn't, but ultimately, you know, if this is an episode kind of about choice, his choices matter and hers don't. Like, her desires are not, they just are irrelevant to him. He's like, this is a choice that you make, so I'm going to leave, versus, like, this is a time when I'm stepping in, you know, and you could tie it back to when he left her in Victorian England for a while in Deep Breath, in his premiere episode, where it just seems like he is just deciding what he wants to do and is not concerned about her emotional reality. And there are some very practical things, like at the end when she says, did you know what would happen? And he said, well, I figured that, you know what, somebody wouldn't destroy his nest. The animal wouldn't destroy where he was born. Like, that's actually just a crucial piece of information that would have been really helpful in making this decision. And for him to withhold that is incredibly paternalistic and patronizing. And she's absolutely right to call him out for that. And I think, there are plenty of episodes where the Doctor or previous Doctors have acted very similarly to this. We'll actually talk about one of them today, actually. And he has not been called out this strongly, so it is just really nice to see. I think you're right. The friendship dynamic of that is not there, and to see someone acknowledge that he has too much power in these relationships.
Yeah, I mean, the Doctor is being such a needy, manipulative game player here. Like that's what he's being. You know, he's trying to prove a point that is so obscure that even he cannot articulate it. And what I think is so great about that scene, and like I said, and I try to avoid reading in too much meta stuff in these scenes, but it definitely felt a little bit like Clara was telling Stephen Moffat off as much as she was telling the Doctor off.
Sure.
It's like she is articulating a lot of really valid, overdue. There's no one feminist critique of Doctor Who, but it certainly felt in line with certain feminist critiques of Doctor Who, what she's getting at here. And to say it to a middle-aged Scottish man, like, it definitely, it was like, oh yeah, I feel like there's a little subtext here. Like, this is the ultimate Stephen Moffat saying, yeah, I've read Tumblr, I'm aware of what I've done wrong. Like, but anyway, the point is that, you know, it felt very overdue, and it felt like, you know, a lot of what the Doctor does here is just, it's just a stripped down version of what the 11th Doctor was doing behind a veil of whimsy throughout season 7B. So it definitely feels like this is something that Clara could have called the Doctor out on a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And I know that that Peter Harness, the writer of this episode, and I certainly was very impressed with his work here, has mentioned that this was originally done as a Matt Smith episode, and then when Smith decided to leave, they reconfigured it as a Capaldi episode. And as I said in the review, I really have trouble imagining this is a Smith episode, but all the critiques absolutely apply to the 11th Doctor. I just don't know whether they ever could have landed without the fact that this new Doctor is so, as I say, like, just so stripped down and so openly Time Lordy. Like, I think that that's very essential to the success of this episode, that he's not even trying to hide or be nice about it. Like, you need that kind of meanness of it's time to take the stabilizers off your bike.
And it even opens with him having insulted Courtney and then not even understanding the insult, where he, like, somehow implied to her, or maybe said to her, that she wasn't special. Like, that's how they get to the moon in the first place. So it really starts out with that kind of, you know, the Doctor's attitude and the Doctor's love of kind of taking power, and really kind of his love of manipulating people, that really kicks this all off. So I think that's such an appropriate way to kick off an episode that ends with him getting called out for that behavior.
Yeah, and it's even like when he first introduces himself to the astronauts, and he, like, just immediately declares, I'm, you know, an immortal time-traveling alien, make me your leader, basically.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he doesn't quite say that, he says, I can be of some help, but, like, again, he's not trying to ingratiate himself at all, he's just trying to assert his power and his authority, and then again, he takes that power and authority away later on in the episode, very capriciously, very without any kind of warning. And I think the main astronaut, Hermione Norris's character, who, as I said, I think she's mentioned by name literally once in the entire episode. Her name is Lundvik, but Lundvik just says Pratt as he's going off. And if you know Britishisms, yeah, that's exactly what the Doctor is in that moment. He's just being just a complete idiot.
I thought she was a really interesting character. I think you pointed out as well that she's pretty underdeveloped. But I think the actress does a lot to kind of make it work. And as I mentioned before, I did really appreciate that it was three women making this decision. And I feel like they very specifically chose like three women in three different walks of life, which was interesting. And again, not how you think of these big democratic decisions getting made. You don't think like a school teacher, a scientist, and a teenager are going to be the ones making it. But there was something about it that felt right, that like, okay, we've represented three very different ages, three very different walks of life, and they're going to be the ones entrusted with this decision. Again, I think it's a little frustrating that it just comes down to Clara, like at the last minute, deciding to push, you know, the button to stop the nuclear bombs from going off. But I think the kernel of the idea of these three women deciding it is really, really interesting. And maybe I wish they had done a little bit more with that.
Yeah, I think that there's an interesting idea there that and I think maybe they could have actually said this explicitly in that final scene, that basically the only reason Clara pushes the button in the end is because she knows that's what the doctor would have, like, you know, like, uh-huh. Actually, like, say, even when, you know, even if you remove yourself, I know what you're going to do. And so I just, you know what I mean? Like, I think that might have been an interesting way to suggest, like, even when you're not there, it doesn't remove your power from the situation because, you know, you've trained me too well. Mm-hmm. You can't, like, turn around and say, oh, now go make a decision, as though everything you taught and lectured and badgered me about all this time suddenly goes away.
This episode plays as kind of like an interesting reversal or maybe commentary on The Beast Below, where we kind of get the reverse situation. That's one of the few times when the Doctor really loses control and is about to make the wrong decision. He's about to kill the Star Whale, and it's only Amy's, you know, really intense powers of observation that is able to save the day and convince him it's wrong. And this, I don't know, this is not the direct inverse, but it feels like somehow it's thematically linked to that. And I think Amy and Clara are such different characters. It's also really interesting to see them in these situations. And it felt so right that Clara got pushed too, like, it felt so true to her character that this was a situation that pushed Clara too far. Indeed, it would be a situation that would push anyone too far. But it was interesting to see a story being told about her that I really don't think could have been told really about any of the other companions. I'm not sure they all quite would have responded like this. So it felt very true to her throughout the whole episode.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I said in my review is, you know, I think this is actually where Clara's previous lack of definition actually kind of serves the show to some extent, because she is a companion more than any of the other. We had this debate earlier, how many main companions there are in our one of our pre-show chats. But one of the five companions, she's definitely the one most defined purely in terms of the Doctor as opposed to in terms of herself. And to have a companion so defined by her trust and her faith, and even not necessarily in a romantic sense, but her love of the Doctor, to mm-hmm. have that it all broken and betrayed, I think it's more powerful for it to happen to her. Mm-hmm. And it feels more real that when the breaking point comes, like if this had happened to say, any of the RTD era companions, I don't know whether it would have felt real for them to make such an absolute break. Like, the closest precedent for this is probably Martha mm-hmm. leaving at the end of Last of the Time Lords. And even there, like, she can't, she refuses to really hold Ten responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was maybe a little bit of the show's love for the Tenth Doctor when mm-hmm. it wasn't necessarily justified. And some of it, I think, just because it just felt like, oh, there's just too much fondness there. It's too tied up in other things. Here, it's just like, well, no, Clara, like, has really seen the truth, because that was all there ever was for her to see. And now that she's seen what's actually going on, she's, you know, it felt very real for it to come from her. And I just don't know whether you could have gotten it from any of the RTD era companions or mm-hmm. from Amy, for that matter.
I really liked elsewhere in the episode, I really liked how Danny was used here, even though he wasn't in it much. I appreciated that we didn't get a plot about Clara lying to him, that he actually became like a very ideal and non-judgmental person for her to share this with. I thought was a really unexpected twist. I also continue to really like Ellis George as Courtney. I thought Courtney was really interestingly handled in this episode in terms of she felt like a realistic teenager, but also like one that was understandably overwhelmed by things, but that could also cope like surprisingly well. But I have to say, do you feel like Ellis George got 2 feet taller since the last episode? Am I crazy?
Maybe it has something to do with putting on the spacesuit.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I just felt like she was so much taller here. Maybe she just had a growth spurt or something.
I have to admit, I did not notice that, but I will have to rewatch with an eye towards that. I think it doesn't help that she did most of her scenes in The Caretaker next to Peter Capaldi.
Yeah, maybe that's
and
it.
And most of her scenes here next to Jenna next Coleman. To Clara. And Peter Capaldi is roughly 5 feet taller than Jenna Coleman, because I think everyone is 5 feet taller than Jenna Coleman. She's really short. So that may have had something to do
with
it.
Yeah, that probably was it.
Yeah, especially since I assume, I don't know how much Jenna Coleman usually wears heels in a row, but I'm guessing you have to wear flats when you're doing the astronaut, the space
no,
suit.
She was so just wear her space suit.
The space,
heels,
yeah, the space suit. That's such a thing.
They've made those by 2049.
Oh, they've made those in multiple science fiction shows.
Did you enjoy Courtney in this episode? I know she was a favorite of yours in The Caretaker.
I love Ellis George. I think she's fantastic. And I really enjoyed, particularly, again, her part in The Moral Dilemma, because I thought it was a really nice way of capturing that kind of innocence of mm-hmm. a teenager's perspective. It is still very much that kind of binary right and wrong. And, you know, I do enjoy this idea that, yeah, she's a brat, like, because she's a teenager. Like, most teenagers are brats. Like, you know, that's not, like, a bad thing. And after whiffing in some previous attempts to depict teenage brats, I think they've done really nice work with Courtney. And I think a lot of that is down to what Ellis George brings to it. I think she brings a lot of nuance, particularly for someone her age. So, yeah, I really enjoyed Courtney here. I thought, and I agree with you, I think that Samuel Anderson continues to do really, really beautiful work as Danny Pink. And I think he's also given really good material. Mm-hmm. And I think just generally, you mentioned saying that he's very non-judgmental. I just think generally, I really like how non-judgmental Kill the Moon is of Clara. And I know some fans were like, no, it should be judging her more. But I really like that there's no, there's, you know, it feels like this season in general, I know that there were the put downs have sort of slowly sort of seemed to have ebbed away. Feels like a few weeks since we've had one of those.
For sure.
And this episode in general just let Clara have her say and did not try to push back. Indeed, every attempt the Doctor made to, you know, argue his case was more unconvincing and more, you know, just like clearly being pulled out of his Gallifreyan behind than before. So I liked that.
She does the right thing. Like, she does save the day. It's not, there's no weakness on her part in terms of
none
like, contributing to the plot. It's just, she rightly points out at the end that it did not need to unfold in this dramatic way that you made it unfold at your own whim. So I think it's good that the episode, it's not saying like she is incapable of doing this. So she wants to leave. It's saying that she has realized that this is not a way someone should be treated. And that's kind of why she wants to end the relationship. I guess here at the end, it's also worth pointing out that a lot of people, myself included, have kind of read the initial setup of this episode as maybe like a comment on abortion in some way, because, of course, we are talking about an egg and whether or not we should kill or let that creature live. I don't think it is a metaphor that I'm not sure how intentional the metaphor was on the show's part. I also don't think it's a metaphor that works very well literally. Ultimately, this does come down as like a pro-life angle on that. I don't think that is like what the show is trying to say. I think it is trying to make this more of a sci-fi generalization, but I do want to acknowledge that, like, I also understand why people are trying to make it more of a literal parallel, because you are dealing with this kind of terminology and this imagery, and you have all these women making a choice for all of womankind. And I could totally see, you know, how that is getting a little bit confused and how people are maybe having a negative reaction to that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of very smart people, including our friend and podcast guest Kate Kolzik, have definitely written some very interesting pieces making those arguments. And I certainly don't want to dismiss it out of hand. I mean, I do think that I suspect it's one of those things where I think it is definitely worth remembering this is an issue that is thought of in very different ways in the UK versus the US. And I think there is a cultural difference here that I know some people from the UK, I think my sense is a lot of people in the UK were like, it seems like some people were like, nah, that isn't really like that big of a deal over here. You know, it's not an issue that is particularly emotive, certainly in Great Britain. I understand that Northern Ireland is a different issue. And others were like, yeah, no, I picked up on the allegory, but I don't necessarily think they were making any particular political point. Like, I think if an American show had done this, it would be a lot more compelling to say, surely that's some sort of allegory. I think the other thing that I'll just say, I was surprised by that response. I mean, I definitely picked up on some of the language that was, it seemed, you know, it definitely put the idea in my head. I'm not completely obtuse, but it was like, oh, that's probably just like a cultural difference. Like, again, if it was being made in the U.S., I think it'd be a little different. This reminds me a little bit of Caroline, are you familiar with the controversy surrounding The Unquiet Dead?
No.
So, The Unquiet Dead, which is, for those who don't remember episode titles off the top of their head, that was the third episode of Series 1. That's the Mark Gatiss-written episode in Victorian Cardiff.
Charles Dickens episode.
Yeah, the Charles Dickens episode with the Gelth. And after it came out, Lawrence Miles, who wrote quite a few novels, Doctor Who spin-off novels, and is since no longer doing that in part because of this thing that he wrote, wrote a very long blog post in which basically he said, this episode is racist. I believe he did say it was racist. I don't want to misrepresent his argument. But basically arguing that the Gelth were analogous to aggressive asylum seekers, which is a political issue in the UK. This idea of people, political refugees seeking asylum, and in according to, you know, certain conservative strains of thought, are in some way, you know, dangerous or whatever. You know, it's I don't think it's a particularly well thought out political view, but the idea was that in some way that The Unquiet Dead was buying into that argument and was showing and had a xenophobic subtext to it. Mm-hmm. And so there was quite a bit of controversy, at least from there, about that. And I think that, you know, I was – and it sort of put the idea in my mind because I was looking at a post, and we'll link to this, by Philip Sandifer, who's a very smart writer on things Doctor Who. And he was taking a long look at The Unquiet Dead controversy. And I think one of the things he said that I feel like applies to Kill the Moon was that if The Unquiet Dead – is an allegory for aggressive asylum seekers, it is such a poorly – it's the most poorly constructed allegory for it imaginable, to the extent that it's really hard to credit that that was the intention. And I kind of feel the same way about Kill the Moon because, yeah, I see where you can draw the parallels. But the thing is like part of the, I think the reason people have an issue with it is like the argument makes no sense. But I think that's because there's no argument in there, that I think that – you know, I know that some people have argued like, well, it's analogous to like a parental rights issue and should the father be consulted? And, you know, again, I don't want to dismiss these arguments out of hand. I think that that would be going too far. But I also think it just, to me, it seems much more like they were attempting to progress the Clara doctor dynamic from what we saw in The Caretaker. And that was not primarily about them in some sort of relationship metaphor. And I suspect it's just a subtext that gets in relatively inadvertently. So anyway, that's my spiel connecting it to a previous Doctor Who controversy. But again, I think there's plenty of room for smart people to disagree on this.
Yeah, I do think that this is a little bit more of an obvious... I see the connection here more than I do in The Unquiet Dead, because I do think anytime you're talking about should we have a baby be born or not be born, it is such charged language. And maybe you're right that it is a cultural thing. But I think
asylum seeking, that's not an issue in the U.S. That is a really big issue in the U.K. And Doctor Who is a British show. I mean, I totally hear you. But again, neither of us is – well, I'm not primarily British and you're not British. I don't know. I mean, I agree with you, but I also think, you know, this is something where we should remember this is a country, this is a show being made in a foreign country, and not all the assumptions are going to be the same.
Mm-hmm. I think it comes down to Doctor Who kind of wanting sci-fi to be metaphor when it wants it to be, and wanting sci-fi to be just fun when it wants it to be. Like, more so, I think most sci-fi shows take one route or the other in terms of, like, you know, Star Trek is very much about we're making analogies for real life, whereas something like Firefly is a lot more like we're using sci-fi tropes to tell, like, a fun story that's not, you know, it can be really compelling, but it's not meant to directly reflect something in our world. And I think Doctor Who tries to do both.
To use Ben Wyatt from Parks and Recreation's term for Game of Thrones, it's telling human stories in Firefly Station, a sci-fi world. Like, that's sort of, that's the Firefly approach. I know what you're saying. I mean, but again, I don't really remember the last time Doctor Who did a huge, like, political allegory in the new series. Like, it does moral dilemmas. Like, it does stuff like, say, A Town Called Mercy, or, I don't know, Boomtown and The Girl Who Waited, which we'll be discussing in a second, where it's like, I know that Boomtown is sort of a capital punishment allegory, but it isn't really, because most people don't argue about capital punishment in terms of should the cop turn over a fugitive to the government to be executed. It's more – so I feel like Doctor Who, at least in the new series, because there are definitely a few political allegories in the classic series, but in the new series, it doesn't really do political allegories. It does, like, moral debates, you know, and to me, again, it seems so far away from what Doctor Who normally does that it just seems unlikely to me that that was the primary, secondary, or tertiary intent. But again, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be obtuse here. I do understand where people are coming from.
I guess at the very least, it's odd that someone along the way didn't look at it and think like, oh, is this coming across? You know what I mean? Even if the intention was like in my notes for this halfway through, I wrote in all caps, is this an episode about abortion? So I think because it's occurring to so many people, and again, maybe it's all cultural. I have to think that, you know, they're very aware their show is airing in America and has a big audience here. I guess I'm just surprised that no one raised the question along the way and thought maybe we should handle this with a little more nuance, perhaps. Again, it's not like a huge concern that I have about the episode, but it is interesting to me to see that that's been such a response and that maybe there could have been a little bit more thoughtfulness in terms of how that was tackled or the rote in which we led this plot in terms of making it perhaps avoiding some controversy that I don't think they were ultimately trying to court there.
No, I mean, I would say, again, I agree that the language is there. And again, neither I'm not an expert on the cultural context. I'd be surprised if neither Peter Harness nor Stephen Moffat nor anyone involved at no point it occurred to them, hey, this is a little bit like abortion. But I think where I blanch a little bit is that I think that to argue that this is somehow a pro-life argument, that to me is asking, I think, too much of the available evidence to make that case. It is, I think that that's where I have to say, I think I have real trouble believing that that's the intention. But whether they wanted to kick around ideas in that area for giggles or whatever, maybe.
Yeah, I think it comes down to what we opened this conversation about, where that while the Clara doctor stuff works so well, the suspense stuff works pretty well, even the Courtney Danny stuff works so well, there's something about this central moral conflict that feels a little muddied, you know, even taking the abortion parallel out of it. I just think that there's something about that that, again, it's that fridge logic thing. When you start thinking about it, it doesn't quite work. And then when you make a situation that it's so easy to put a real world parallel on top of, I think it's just, it's a little bit too muddy for its own good. The episode is still strong despite that, but I do kind of see how all of this, that central sort of thing, as cool as it is, the idea that the moon is an egg, which I do think was like a delightfully cool idea. I loved that that reveal. I still think there's something about that that could have been a little more clear.
I think this is the telling thing. When you were about to say that central thing, I was like, oh, you mean Clara telling the doctor off? Because that to me is the central thing of the episode. But no, I mean, and I will certainly say, I think that it's a good rule of thumb that if so many people are interpreting the episode differently than it was intended, then yeah, something went a little off in the execution of the episode. And I suspect it's not just a cultural gap. I think you're right that there are probably a few too many gaps in the construction of this episode. Mm-hmm. And the episode invites people to fill it in more than perhaps should be necessary. And this is where I think we're seeing some of the problems. You know, as I said in my review, the reason why I gave it an A grade, it isn't because it's a flawless episode. It isn't. And I would be willing to acknowledge more flaws than I even did in the review. But I think it surprised me and it did things that I hadn't seen the show do before. And so that put me in mind of Listen, which I think is the other really strong episode this season. And so that's why at the end, I think it is really, really great episode. But I think it's, you know, there's definitely some things that could have been a lot better here on the margins, at least.
I have to say, I really enjoy that we both liked this episode and yet the things we liked and disliked about it are like polar opposite. I actually really enjoy that we can see different strengths and weaknesses and yet both came out in favor of the episode. I wonder, in fact, if that will happen in our part two discussion.
I thought we both liked Clara telling the doctor.
Oh, that's true. No, we did. But I would say,
what parts did, wait, so just let's do the quick taxonomy here. I thought the first half was fine. You thought it was better than fine.
Yeah.
And then I thought the moral dilemma was perfunctory but well acted.
Yeah, and I thought it was pretty unclear and like problematic but not problematic in a way that took away from the entire episode.
Okay, that's fair. So I think it's that middle section.
Yeah.
Where, as I say, because I didn't see it as the central point of emphasis for the episode, mm-hmm. It wasn't as big a deal for me, but clearly a lot of other people did see it as the central point of emphasis for that episode. And to be fair, the Clara thing happens in the final 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask everyone to agree with me that that's the that's the real takeaway of the episode, but to me it does feel like this sort of unexpected but inexorable march towards that point. Anyway, I think we should probably take a break here. We're almost like an hour in.
There's a lot to talk about.
There was a lot to talk about.
They were trying to kill the whole darn moon.
I thought you were going to say they were trying to kill this podcast.
Trying to kill this podcast.
Yeah, so anyway, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with a pair of other Moral Dilemma episodes, Boomtown and The Girl Who Waited. Stick around. Welcome back, everyone, to the second half of Debating Doctor Who. We've got a couple episodes here. Caroline, your original theme, what was your original theme for this? Remind me.
It was when the Doctor has to make a some sort of big decision, because that's how they were billing Kill the Moon, was all about this one big decision. Although, I have to say, I'm really bummed there was not an egg in The Girl Who Waited. Otherwise, my theme could have been Doctor Who plots that involve eggs.
Well, I want to propose another theme as well that ties all three of these. I think these are the three most preposterous plot setups in Doctor Who history, other than Girl in the Fireplace. That one, if you sit down and think about it, may still be the silliest plot in Doctor Who history. But these three involve some very unlikely roads to what may or may not, depending on what we think about them, some engaging moral dilemmas. So we're going to kick off with Boomtown. I love saying Boomtown. Just, you can really lean into the boom. Anyway, Caroline, tell us about Boomtown.
Well, Alistair, in Boomtown, it's basically a sequel of sorts to Aliens of London, World War III, in which the Slovene return, courtesy of Margaret Blaine, a.k.a. Blonde Felfotch, who, since that episode, has moved to Cardiff, somehow become the mayor, and already created plans to build a nuclear power plant, which she can explode in order to open the Cardiff Rift, destroy Earth, and ride her way to doing more nefarious things across the universe.
Would that be ride on her intergalactic surfboard?
Yeah, I was thinking of it as a skateboard, but I think surfboard works as well.
The point is, it's like, some sort of board.
Yes, like a Back to the Future
God,
style.
God, can you imagine how awful the CGI of pulling that off would have been? Anyway, yeah, so what happened? So this episode.
Yeah, so as Margaret is coming up with her evil plan, the Doctor, Rose, and Jack actually land in Cardiff as well, conveniently, considering that's where the show is filmed, to refuel the TARDIS on a Cardiff Rift. Rose invites Mickey for a visit, and he kind of briefly joins the team to capture Margaret, and then they plan to take her back to Raxacoracofallopatorius.
Well done.
While she reveals that her home planet has the death penalty, and she will therefore be killed on arrival. So the second half of this episode, Rose and Mickey are off trying to sort out their relationship, while Margaret and the Doctor go on this kind of dinner date, where she tries through every means possible to convince him to let her go. In the end, she kind of unveils this big plan B, tries to rip apart the TARDIS and ride away. That goes awry. She looks into the heart of the TARDIS and she gets transformed into an egg. So the Doctor decides he will just take that egg back to Raxacoracofallopatorius.
Well done.
And have it be raised into a better Slovene than Margaret was originally. And those are the kooky mishaps of Boomtown, which is an episode I go back and forth on. The last time I rewatched it, I was really into it, and this time I was less won over by it. I have to say, it feels like a very season one episode, and I don't know if I mean that as a compliment. Like, it definitely feels like the show is still trying to find its feet in a way where when you look at later episodes, especially something like The Girl Who Waited, I feel like the show just knows what it's trying to do with a lot more confidence than it does here. That being said, it's really admirable how much the show kind of tries to break the mold and do something very, very different. Like, this is ultimately just a relationship episode. There is kind of that interesting moral dilemma of should they bring Margaret back and have her be killed, or should they find some sort of alternate plan. I think the lack of plotting, or the kind of nonsensical plotting, ultimately is drags the episode down too much for me to consider it kind of a classic. What about you?
Yeah, I'm kind of with you, and I have to admit, I had the same feeling when I went and rewatched this one, because when the last time I rewatched it was for the AV Club reviews that I was writing of series one, and I think I gave it a B+. I remember being pretty positive about the episode, and I think that this is a good example of one where maybe not with every RTD episode, but certainly with the ones that are really super RTD, and this is a really super RTD kind of episode, I think I kind of have to lean into them a bit. Like, I think I have to watch, like, I have to kind of be in the swing of his style and his approach. Like, it's hard to drop into Boomtown cold. Like, if you've watched the preceding 10 episodes of the season, I think you're just a little more on the wavelength of this episode. You know what I mean? Like, it just...
Totally.
Because, man, like, you feel like... You do feel like Mickey in this episode just showing up, and, like, the three companions, the Doctor, Rose, and Jackie, are just so, like, over the top in love with each other and kind of gratingly so in the early going. And there's just a lot of goofy jokes, and the farting is... done better here than it's done in this first Levine two-parter, because Joe Ahern, the director, basically, I think, and in consultation with RTD, the writer, basically said, yeah, we'll do this like once or twice at the beginning and then forget about it. But yeah, so I, you know, it's one of those ones where the big virtue of it, I think, is it just feels so different from almost any other episode.
Yeah, I do think, and this is the time when the show is very much, you know, it's so new and it is really trying to find itself. And I can appreciate it trying to make these stabs at doing something different. And there are things to like here. I actually quite enjoy the dynamic between the Rose and the Doctor and Jack. And I like how we get to kind of feel like Mickey for a while, like we're an outsider. We don't normally see them so chummy, referencing things we haven't seen. So I think the episode does a good job of putting us into Mickey's shoes there. Actually, I think the strongest parallel that this episode has to Kill the Moon, I kind of thought it would be that central moral dilemma, but I actually think it's the relationship between Rose and Mickey, which in some ways kind of speaks to the relationship between 12 and Clara, where there's like an imbalance of power there. Like Rose has all this power to come and go, and she just kind of expects Mickey to be at her beck and call. And the kind of central problem there is that Mickey is now kind of taken up with this other girl. And I thought that there was a lot of interesting parallels there that I certainly had never thought about before. But, you know, as much as we see Rose kind of being the person with less power in her relationship with the Doctor, we also see how she's, you know, not necessarily treating Mickey with the respect that he deserves either. And I think Noel Clark does some nice work in this episode. Like, I didn't quite know he had that in him, based on at least what we saw when he was first introduced in Rose.
Yeah, it's interesting watching this a week after we did School Reunion, because I know that Christmas Invasion is in between there, and indeed Parting of the Ways, Noel Clark is in that. But those to me are the two in the sort of Mickey arc evolution, are two of the biggest episodes, and to watch the next step in his evolution, you know, before we watch this one, is interesting, because I think you're right. Like, Mickey is definitely starting to assert himself, and at least being a lot more open about what his needs are, and I think it's interesting when he says, you know, I'm not going to ask you to leave him. I know that's not fair. But at the same time, you know, when Rose does run off, it's like, oh, no, it's always going to be him, isn't it? It's never going to be me, and so forth, which has some interesting echoes also with what he says to the 10th Doctor in Rise of the Cybermen, which is written by Tom McRae, who also wrote The Girl Who Waited. It's like 6 degrees of Doctor Who in here. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, as much as I have some issues with Boomtown, or more to the point, I just go back and forth on whether I more enjoy the good stuff or am more irritated by the silly stuff. I do actually think overall this is I feel like successful isn't the right adjective. It's just like, it's a very ambitious episode for an episode that clearly was done to save a ton of money and was written really quickly. Cause I know it's the final episode Russell T. Davies wrote before the finale, which means he wrote it in like 2 days. if any past precedent, like that's like notoriously that he just would write these at the end of seasons really quickly. And I think overall it comes out well. I think if I have one sort of big picture critique of this one, I wish that it had the guts, and I don't know whether there is this sort of BBC mandate that everything has to end with a proper alien attack sequence. I kind of wish that Margaret didn't have a plan that she was running the whole time, that she wasn't scamming the Doctor, that you actually forced the Doctor to fully confront it. Because I think they get to some interesting ideas here with where... you know, is the Doctor more like Margaret than he wants to admit? And certainly another episode that this is a lot of parallels with is A Town Called Mercy, which I think ends up executing that part a little bit better. Because again, it is that thing of, a lot of it is the sort of Hannibal Lecter thing where it's clearly manipulation, but there's some truth to it, and that's what makes the manipulation so effective. So I think the fact that it to some extent is revealed to be a scam or a con while she's waiting for her, whatever, the extrapolator to do whatever it's going to do, is a little disappointing, but You know, for the like 2 or 3 minutes there where it really commits to the moral debate, I think it's some of the best stuff Doctor Who's done.
Yeah, and since moral debate is the theme of debating Doctor Who this week, I think that that's a good thing to talk about for a while. I enjoy that the scene that always sticks out in my mind in Boomtown is that scene where Margaret is talking to Kathy in the bathroom and plans to kill her. And then when Kathy says she's about to get married and she's pregnant, Margaret kind of has this crisis of consciousness and decides not to kill her. And then that again is referenced when she goes out to dinner with the doctor and she tries to argue like, look, I let one person go. I deserve to live. And the episode does a good job of making me on Margaret's side. Like that scene, she is very sympathetic. And even the way the alien looks, there's something kind of sad and sympathetic about it. And I'm kind of on team Margaret until the doctor rightfully points out that the body you're in is someone that you killed and stripped and you used her skin. So I actually think it does a pretty compelling job of making us see both of those points of views. I think what is really disappointing is that it essentially just decides not to make any decision at the end and have Margaret revert to an egg, which always feels like a cop-out for this like really cool dilemma that they set up.
There's a reason the term Davies ex machina exists, and I'm pretty sure that's not the first time I've said this on the podcast, but this is a real Davies ex machina. I mean, specifically using the sort of heart of TARDIS to regress her to an egg. Because, I mean, it does. It sidesteps the question of should the doctor have to make a difficult choice, which I think in practice was one of those things where I think the Davies era tended to give the doctor a lot of really difficult choices to make and then kind of let him get out of jail free at the end. And, you know, we'll deal with other ones when they come up. But this definitely feels like an example of that, because I don't know what the right answer to this one is. I don't know what the doctor should or should not do. I'll admit that. But I will say, to compare it again to Star Trek, which I think does a lot of these kind of moral dilemmas, I feel like that's a show that's more willing to follow through with it and let the characters sometimes make a decision that they don't know whether it's right or wrong and have to live with it. And here it feels like maybe the doctor should have to live with making a right or wrong decision more than he ends up having to.
I think what helps keep that from like overwhelming the episode is the moment where the doctor rightly identifies to Margaret that by letting this one woman go, she somehow feels like she can justify all of her other actions to herself. I think that's a really good and interesting observation. And then she, right back to him, says, like, you must have killed before because you're able to identify that. And that's a really interesting moment where we get a little bit of a questioning of the doctor, sort of, you know, is he good? Is he all good? This is a time when we don't know a ton about the doctor. So even if the episode at the end kind of cops out, at least there's that one moment where we kind of like imply that he's not, you know, this all-knowing good being. Should have been way more of that, but I'm glad that little moment is there.
Yeah, well, I feel like there's sort of two choices in where this can go. One is, should the doctor deliver somebody if he knows that that person to a justice system where he knows that person is going to be executed. Mm-hmm. And that's one where I really don't know how you resolve that one in a satisfying way beyond just basically forcing the doctor to make a hard choice and then live with it, which would be a dark place to go, really, whatever choice he makes, or to sort of shift it towards, is Margaret more like the doctor than he cares to admit, which is basically, is Margaret manipulating him by playing on his worst fears, or is she actually really onto something, or is it kind of both? And I think that either of those options would be very interesting to play around with, but I think, again, the fact, and I think that probably the latter would have been easier to sort of resolve in 10 minutes, as opposed to, I think you kind of would have had to have done something to maybe redeem Margaret just enough that the doctor could maybe look the other way. I don't know. Again, I understand why they ended up going in this very strange other direction, because I will admit these are really hard to resolve in a satisfying way. But, you know, again, I think Boomtown could have followed through on its convictions more than it ended up doing.
Well, and Caroline's crazy theory corner for the week, I was looking at
this is a new segment. I'm very proud of it right now. Yep.
In looking at like, okay, this regressing to an egg, admittedly, I don't think there was a ton of like intention, like smart, interesting thematic intention behind that. But hey, what is the point of analyzing the show if we can't overanalyze it? So this is what I came up with as my justification for the egg, because the doctor, when he's looking at the egg and like speculating on how this happened, he says the TARDIS is telepathic, gets inside your head. Maybe the raw energy can translate all kinds of thoughts. What I took from that was that there was something redeemable in Margaret, and she realized that she had done too much bad to be worthy of redemption in this life. So somehow, in looking into the TARDIS, she communicated to the TARDIS that she wanted a chance to start over, and then the TARDIS, like, gave her the power to be a baby again. So that in some way, she was, like, active in that choice, and it wasn't just like, oh, this was a random thing that happened, that somehow it was translating her wishes and her desire for redemption that we had seen when she had decided to save Kathy. Again, do I think all of that was meant to be there? No. But do I think there's a way to read the episode that way? Maybe.
Oh, I actually don't think that's too crazy. I think that's more or less what it does intend. I think that's actually in the text of the episode, or at least pretty in the subtext. Because I think that, you know, she has that moment where she's like, says thank you to the doctor. And then I will say, I think Christopher Eccleston, I mean, just generally, Christopher Eccleston tends to be very good as the Ninth Doctor. I don't really know whether there's certainly, by this point, he knows what he's doing as the Ninth Doctor, even if he probably had one foot out the door at this point, because I know that he was not very happy on set, but I do enjoy that final scene where it's just like, good work, team. And, you know, it's a sort of wrap-up thing where it's like he's sort of the boss of a team, but, you know, even he is sort of kind of being contemplative about it, and you know, even he doesn't quite know what's happened. I think it's a nicely played moment, and I think that it kind of helps sell the idea that, you know, he doesn't quite understand how this has happened, but he's pretty sure he knows what's happened, and as you say, that it is, you know, that Margaret got her wish, and, you know, it'll be another chance. So, you know, I feel like the Ninth Doctor kind of pulls that end together. It's still a cheat. It's still a major cheat of what the episode suggests it's going to do. You know, I do think, again, it's one of those things where I think you have to, what the problem with these sorts of episodes is they're big thinking episodes. And so they ask you to engage your brain, but they also kind of need you to shut off your brain for vast portions of it to make it work. Like you have to ignore, how does anyone get elected mayor of a major British city without ever having her photograph taken? Like, that's not a thing. Like, you know, there's a lot of, like, really crazy ideas here in order to get to the idea that no one noticed, hey, isn't that one of the people who was in Downing Street during that alien invasion? Like, a lot of, there's a lot of loose ends here in order to get her to a place where the doctor can go after her. But, you know, again, I think everyone kind of knows, who's watched the show, that Boomtown is not a flawlessly constructed hour of television.
Well, speaking of loose ends and plot holes that can maybe be detrimental, I would actually love to talk about The Girl Who Waited and hopefully talk about it in comparison to Boomtown, because it was fascinating watching these two back to back, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Let's do this. Let's do Girl Who Waited. Okay, so as I mentioned, this is written by Tom McRae. This is his one other script other than that Cybermen two-parter. And this is picking up in the back half of series 6. This is coming after Night Terrors, and as I imagine many of you are asking, what is Night Terrors? Because no one remembers Night Terrors, but it's also right before God Complex, Closing Time, and Wedding of River Song. And basically, they're going to Apalapachia, another very difficult to pronounce planet. Indeed, they take up the first like 30 seconds of the episode repeating the name of the planet, which is the second most beautiful place in the universe. But it's under quarantine, and they end up in this Two Streams facility, where basically the idea is that if the Apalapachians, if they get this plague, it kills them in a day, but they get put in the red waterfall side of the facility, where they are able, where time is compressed, and they feel their entire life elapse over the course of a single day. So only a day has happened, but it feels to them, and indeed they physically age, as though decades have happened, and they get to busy themselves doing whatever they want to do. The Doctor and Rory go into the Green Anchor stream, which is normal time. Amy, who's coming after them, goes into the red waterfall and basically gets, you know, separated from them. And as we find out, when the Doctor and Rory try to save her, she ends up being stuck there for 36 years and having to spend all that time defending herself against these quarantine robots, which just want to cure her, but the cure will almost certainly kill her because she's not Apalapachian. And over this time, she's become incredibly bitter and angry, particularly at the Doctor, who she despises now. And then there's a lot of stuff that happens, essentially, where Rory and older Amy argue about whether they should try to save younger Amy, and then older Amy and younger Amy are reunited through some time stuff, and older Amy says, you're going to take me with you as well, but the doctor, he initially claims that it's possible, but he reveals later, no, he always knew that it would be impossible, that that paradox could never be resolved, and at the end of it, he initially locks older Amy out, and then older Amy and Rory find themselves on either side of the TARDIS door. Rory almost lets her back in because he loves Amy, older Amy ultimately says, don't do it, because you should, you know, I want younger Amy to have all the years with you that I didn't get to have. So that's more or less, I think that's a fairly comprehensive synopsis.
A very confusing episode.
Of the girl who waited. So that's more or less what happens there. So Carolyn, I think you've been dancing around. You have some issues with this episode, so let's just get into them.
Okay, well, I have to say, first of all, in a first for debating Doctor Who, watching this episode specifically for this podcast has given me a 180 perspective on The Girl Who Waited, an episode I was not too fond of. I loved it today. I was so emotionally invested. I was sobbing by the end. It felt like I was watching an entirely different episode. So that was a really exciting moment.
Can I just pause for 1 second? Because I know you had only watched Girl Who Waited once before, right? Uh-huh. Like when you were initially going through. Was that at a time when you still didn't like Amy? Or had you warmed to her by the time you got to this?
I think I was still a little more hesitant on her.
Okay, because this is a very Amy episode.
It is.
And that may have been a contributing factor.
I do want to get into like my problem that I originally had.
Yeah, tell us about your journey with this episode.
With The Girl Who Waited. Yeah, it's been a journey. So what happened, I think, was that what I consider kind of a plot hole in the beginning, I spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I think because my mindset was in that plot hole, I was very much trying to intellectualize this episode. And I think that's why I didn't like it, because I don't think on an intellectual level it necessarily works that well. This time on rewatching, you know, deciding to put aside that plot hole, I could watch it emotionally. And in that sense, I really, really enjoyed it. So the plot hole is this. If, from your point of view, when you go into the red waterfall area, you just get to live out your full life. Like say you husband and wife, the wife gets sick. She gets to go live out her whole life in the red waterfall. Why wouldn't the husband just go in there with her and then they could live out the entirety of their lives together? Like essentially what is happening from your point of view is that you're getting cured because you get to live out your whole life. So if they have the technology to compress this time, but everything else stays the same except you're not sick. In fact, why wouldn't you just move your whole society into that other time? And then you would essentially be curing this disease.
Well, I do, but then the society would die out in a day. The entire society would be gone. Because it's not that they're being cured, it's just that it takes a day to kill you, and you're having an entire lifetime compress.
But from your
into a
point
day.
Of view, it doesn't matter. Like, only matters if you're super dependent on, like, the rest of the universe or something.
Well, yeah, but if you want, but you're not going to be able to have any children in a day. So you can't perpetuate your species. You could have that one generation.
But she ages 36
years. Right, but she doesn't have to eat at any point in that time. So you're aging physiologically, but I will admit that that does seem like a contradiction. But I think the fact that Amy didn't have to eat over the course of the week that she perceived being in there. So you're physically aging, but I would assume that that's inconsistent. I'm just going to say that right now. You know, I think it's one of those things where if they were sitting down and thinking this through, they probably would have said, well, wait, for this to work logically, Amy probably shouldn't age up at all. But then, which I think would make it consistent and help explain. And I think the other thing I would say is, again, it is a quarantine facility. You're trying to stop the spread of this plague. And it's possible that a few husbands and wives did decide to live out a life with their. But, you know, if you have children and you want them to grow up and have, you know, proper lives. And it is, you know, it's a galactic travel destination. So presumably it is a, you know, fairly plugged in society, possibly with a larger society that exists beyond just this one planet. So anyway, I mean, again, if I'm needing this much time to explain this, clearly the episode could have spent a little more time rooting around on this issue. But so I don't know whether it's technically a plot hole, but it's an underexplained aspect of the
it's
setup.
Just in a way the world made so little sense to me, and this idea of all these people going to this quarantine facility where, like, yeah, you get to go to the movies and stuff, but ultimately you're still alone for 50 years or however long you live, like, because they said each of these people are in their separate time streams. Like, I know Amy's situation really sucks because these things are trying to kill her, but even if they're not trying to kill her, it just seems like, why would anyone do this? Why would anyone want to live 50 years from your own? Like, I understand from the people's point of view watching them maybe, but like, why would I feel like I'm getting like sick and then I just want to go live alone for, I don't know. The whole setup didn't make sense. So I think because I was intellectualizing that. So I was trying to apply this sort of intellectual bent to the whole episode. Thankfully, this time I was able to say, like, Caroline, just like, this is just Doctor Who. It never makes sense. Like, don't make a bigger thing out of this than you've made about any other episode. And then I think that this episode is so strong. And I think this is an episode that, unlike maybe Boomtown and maybe even Kill the Moon, where it seems like we have some questions about, are we supposed to be applying this in any kind of real world analogy way? I think that The Girl Who Waited is a really great sci-fi plot that asks a lot of big questions about humanity and the nature of relationships and the nature of aging and choices and all that stuff without ever feeling like it wants me to graph that onto a specific real world situation. So I'm not busy trying to think about that. Like, oh, what is the parallel here? I'm just enjoying a really human story told in a really unconventional sci-fi way. And as I said, I just really, really liked watching this episode today.
This might be the most human story of the 11th Doctor's era.
Yeah.
It's I think it's either this or another episode that is pretty much like 100% Amy, Rory, and the Doctor, which is Amy's choice. Like, those to me are two I'd put forward as being the most emotionally aware stories. And I think this one in particular is... Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I've sort of trained myself to just not think about plots with Doctor Who, because that's just, mm-hmm. if you watch Doctor Who for plots, you're just, I don't want to say you're watching Doctor Who wrong, watching Doctor Who wrong. and I think that you're right. Like, this is one of those episodes that, yeah, it definitely works on a character level, and it works on a thematic level, and it's just a really emotional episode, and just really, I mean, there are literally... There's some people doing voiceover work, including the great Imelda Staunton, I believe, if not an Oscar, and I think an Oscar nominee, doing the voice of the interface. And there's that one woman who shows up in a hologram. But other than that, it's literally just Matt Smith, Arthur Darvill, and Karen Gillan for the entire episode. And they are really good in it.
It's really remarkable. Both this and Boomtown, I think, were kind of the like low budget entries that were, you know, very minimal. It's just mainly the central cast that's there. Indeed, Girl Who Waited is one of those Doctor Light episodes, as you pointed out to me last week, actually, the Doctor is in the TARDIS most of the time.
Most brilliantly constructed Doctor Light ever, because you don't notice really it's a Doctor Light. Yep.
But The Girl Who Waited and Boomtown, if we're considering both of these the low budget entries, like, it is just, these are not even on the same planet in terms of like how good they look, how smart they are in the stories that they're trying to tell. I just think Girl Who Waited is so superior, and it's crazy to think that these are, you know, how far Doctor Who has come when it comes to like a low budget episode.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, the thing that really hit me this time as I was, and I agree, it's a really beautiful looking episode. But the thing that really hits me this time, and I think a big reason why I think Girl Who Waited works as well as it does, I mentioned before, I love the performances episode, but Karen Gillan is so good as the older Amy. Like, it's the best work she does on the show, in my opinion, because it's so, her physicality is completely different. It's such a withdrawn performance. Like, she won't meet Rory in the eyes because she's not used to looking at anyone in the eyes after 36 years. Like, it's a much gruffer performance, but it's like, and I don't know whether you know this, but the original plan was to get an older actress to play older Amy.
Yeah, I read that
Amy.
Today.
And Karen Gillan said, no, I'm pretty sure I can play this. And they're like, okay, let's see how this goes. And oh my God, it works out so well, and I cannot imagine how that ever would have worked. Because, you know, it is like that thing worth, like, you know, it's like the Looper thing where you're trying to sell Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis as the same person. It's like, yeah, they're good actors, so it's fine, but it's like, they're not the same person at all. But yeah, this one, it is just a really beautifully nuanced performance by Karen Gillan as the older Amy, and then she's also able to hang on to, like, what the younger Amy is, and you know, when they're playing off against each other, it just works so well. And it's such a, it's, as I said, I think it's the best work she does on the show. It's a real showcase for her.
It's really remarkable. You don't even quite realize how different she is as older Amy until younger Amy comes back and you really see the two of them, you know, in one scene together. But I think you're right that she carries so much of this episode, and she really sells the heartache of those lost 36 years, which of course are, you know, heartbreaking to hear about on paper, but just like seeing how much sadness she's able to convey. And the moment that really stands out to me is when she, you know, meets Rory again and he's young and she like considers putting lipstick on. Like, it's such a thoughtful moment that is all told visually. Like, you know, there's no, it's not even highlighted that much. I just really like that. Like, that conveys so much about who this woman has become in this time, and just really nice world building. Like, she has the little robot who she's named Rory, and she's cut off his hands. And I don't know, there's a definite like Castaway feel here, I think. And it all just works really, really well.
Yeah. And again, as I alluded to earlier, we were having a little debate on GChat as to how many main companions there are in Doctor Who. And I think the correct answer is there are five. Rory is not a main companion. But I will say, I know that Amy is the title character of this episode, but this to me, more than any other episode, kind of feels like a Rory episode. I agree. He's the emotional fulcrum of this episode. And while Amy's arc is flashier, like, you know, she kind of dropped, well, certainly young Amy is not in this episode very much. And while older Amy's journey is pivotal, like, Rory is the one being forced to make the really difficult decisions here in a way that I don't think he ever quite is in any other episode. At least I'm not remembering any other ones where his struggles are so foregrounded. And I love the moment. It's so raw, and Arthur Darvill nails it, where he's saying, you know, why would you not, you know, grab a history book and check to see when a plague is going on? And the 11th Doctor, in a moment that is just like so completely, like, that's a moment where you say, where you apologize. You do not try to defend yourself. And he's just like, I don't travel that way. And it's like, then I don't want to travel with you. And he just throws the glasses on the ground, and it's such a raw moment from Rory. And again, it as we say, Matt Smith not in this episode very much, and no other actors of beyond one hologram are in this, so it really is an episode that sinks or swims on both Gillan and Darvill, and they're both there. It's probably series best work from both of them, honestly.
I think this episode for Rory is what Kill the Moon is for Clara. There's actually a ton of parallels here in terms of the Doctor just being like a jerk, both in terms of what he does and even more so in terms of how he's dealing with other people's emotions. And it's so nice to see Rory call him out on it here. I don't think he quite goes to the extent that Clara does in Kill the Moon. That would have been nice to see too. But I have to say, even though they made this story the way it is because it's a Dr. Light episode, they just wanted Matt Smith to be able to film in the TARDIS. It works so well to have him separated from the other two, because his performance is just like necessarily less empathetic because he's not in the room with them. And it just adds this whole other, like, I hated the 11th Doctor in this episode. I could not stand him. It felt like he was making the wrong choices all the time. It felt like he could not deal with the emotional reality of the situation. And as we see in Kill the Moon, he wanted to have all the power and make all the choices and use his companions as little pawns. And his something about his performance just like lacks the empathy that Matt Smith can certainly get to. And we saw just last week in Closing Time, I think that's a really empathetic performance. Whereas this one is, there's just something that's a little bit more like scientific about it. And it is like so, I don't know, it's so difficult for me to watch because I'm like, these people are going through real things, and you really come to love old Amy by the end. And even if you know she can't make it back into the TARDIS with them necessarily, like that seems kind of like where the plot has to end up, it's still so cruel to see him treat her like that. Like, there was one moment where she's outside the TARDIS and she yells, "Doctor, please, I trusted you." And he just looks at Rory and says, "She's not real." And we've just spent the past, 40 minutes proving that she is real. And it is like one of the cruelest things this Doctor ever does, I think.
I agree with you. And I think that, this is actually, I think, kind of supports my point. So I look great. but kind of going back to what I was saying with like the reason why Kill the Moon, I can only imagine it working as a Capaldi episode, is it's so much harder to remain angry at the 11th Doctor. And I think you're right that they basically had to quarantine him and not allow him to play off anyone physically and not give him anyone to like bounce off with and develop a true on-screen rapport with, because the second he does that, he becomes so much more likable. And the only way to make him alien and remote is to isolate him physically. And then you sort of start to see, oh, this is the Time Lord underneath the boyish exterior, and it is scary, and it's not a nice person. And I think that, the thing about Capaldi in Kill the Moon is he can get there with other people in the room. And so that's a kind of distinction between the 11th and the 12th Doctors, and why Kill the Moon really, I think, could only work as a 12th Doctor episode. That I think you're absolutely right, that Girl Who Waited, I don't think you're supposed to like the 11th Doctor at all in this episode. No. And I think that, Series 6 is a really interesting beast. I think it's the most interesting season of Doctor Who in the sense that it's both amazing and terrible all at the same time. But this does feel like Girl Who Waited is this sort of overdue exploration of like what was going on in the sort of big Moffat arc of the season and like the character impact of that in a sort of microwave. It's like, oh right, like this is examining how badly the 11th Doctor treats his companions and how much he screws up their life in the space of one episode. It's like, you know, these are points you could have been making in all these other episodes instead of kind of eliding them, but it's nice to at least see it addressed here for an entire episode in a fairly deep way. I don't think it like fixes the fact that the other episodes sort of missed that side of it, mm-hmm. but it does at least feel like, you know, I do tend to think Series 6 ends really strongly in its final four episodes. This, and certainly I know we both love God Complex and Closing Time, and this to me feels like the sixth season sort of rounding itself into shape and starting to address the character stuff in the final series of episodes.
Yeah, and talking about, comparing this to Boomtown and Kill the Moon, where ultimately things work out okay. Like, even if the Doctor has this dilemma or handles things poorly, it's all resolved and it's fine. This is an episode where it's really not fine. Like, it's fine in the sense that young Amy's still alive, but it's really not fine in the fact that, like, old Amy just dies. Like, that's the reality of the situation, that they just let her die. And yes, technically she never existed, but, you know, as I feel like they always say in Doctor Who, like, you remember it, therefore it existed. And in that sense, like, This is like one just a terrible action for the Doctor to do, in a way that even leaving Clara and Kill the Moon, I don't know if reaches this level of like literally letting someone die. So I really appreciate how the show kind of doesn't cheat us out of that unhappy conclusion. I guess it does a little bit in that, like, you know, by episode's end, young Amy's back, it's all okay. But it doesn't feel like something coming in and making everything, you know, the happy third alternative where everything's okay. This actually feels like it makes us, the episode says there's a choice has to be made, and then a choice is made, and we as the audience and the characters themselves have to deal with the fallout of that choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if I have one note for the end of Girl Who Waited, it's probably just that I wish Rory was still a bit madder at the Doctor at the end of it. I think that he doesn't quite forgive him, but I think he just goes to be with his wife, and I can't necessarily argue that, because that feels very true to Rory, but you know, but I guess the other thing is, you know, let's not forget, as I mentioned, the next episode is the God Complex, and the mm-hmm. Doctor does force Amy and Rory to leave at the end of the God Complex, partially on the grounds, if you stay with me, you're going to get hurt. And I think that they could have made more explicit connections between Girl Who Waited and God Complex, just to add a little extra resonance, but it's hard not to think that at least on a, you know, on a subtextual level, that this episode is part of what the 11th Doctor is thinking of when he makes that decision in the very next episode to separate himself from them.
I do at times think season 6 tried to be more serialized than any other season.
But then it's super episodic
Then it's super episodic. And I think this is actually an episode that could have benefited from some character serialization, because there's plenty of things for Amy to be mad at that aren't just getting left behind, that, you know, like, again, losing the baby, like being kind of screwed up as a kid. Like, it seems like older Amy could have put some of those things in her condemnation of the Doctor. So in that sense, I do think it being so episodic maybe kind of hurts this, but I have to say it does work so well as a standalone episode, and that I can't quite totally fault it for that. But
no,
I think it could have been a little richer.
I know what you mean. I mean, I think season 6, I think a term I've thrown around before, it's like parallel characterization. It's like characterization that very clearly, like, if you watch Girl Who Waited, you're like, oh yeah, this, like, a lot of these lessons all also apply to, mm-hmm. you know, Good Man Goes to War and Let's Kill Hitler and all that stuff. But the fact that the connection isn't made is weird. And it is like, mm-hmm. why is this so standalone? And I think I like Girl Who Waited as a standalone episode, and I like God Complex as a basically standalone episode. And then Closing Time is more serialized in the sense that it connects into the Doctor's overall struggle, but it still is fairly elliptical in terms of, like, it doesn't really, like, get into it precisely the ways that the Doctor messed up Amy and Rory's lives, and why he is traveling alone now. All three of those episodes feel, again, God Complex and Girl Who Waited more so very standalone, but they're also really mm-hmm. good episodes, and they do have some resonances with the rest of the season. Again, I agree with you. It's weird that, like, it is the most serialized season, but really only in the Moffat-written episodes, and, like, at the tail ends of the episodes that lead in directly to the Moffat episodes. And other than that, it's a lot of, like, standalone parallel characterization. It's a weirdly constructed season. But, again, the results are at least a few really beautiful episodes, and I think this is one of them.
Absolutely. And as I said, I was just like, this episode really got to me on this rewatch. I think I really enjoy episodes where they kind of really let you feel the sadness. And that's what I enjoyed about School Reunion last week. And I think that that's handled so well here. There's a certain, like, I like that Rory really accepts older Amy, and he has that nice line about, like, I'm not mad that you got old. I just wish we had been able to grow old together. And there's, like, a brief second where it seems like they're going to make it work, where old Amy and young Amy and Rory and the doctor are somehow going to, like, figure out this strange dynamic, and everything's going to be okay. And I think it's really bold for the episode not to do that.
And how do you think that the episode kind of, you know, manages the relationship? Because, I mean, you know, a lot of both Amy's actions are very much tied up with the love for Rory. Do you think that they hit the right notes there? Because it feels like one of those things where it could have gone very wrong in the way, easily.
I totally know what you're saying. There's even that line where they're like, should we, you know, blow up all of our time loops or whatever for a boy? And I think it's something you mentioned with Closing Time last week, where it doesn't feel like we're just saying that, like, all girls should be in love with all boys and that's the way the world should be. It feels like we're very specifically talking about Amy and Rory's relationship. And because we know it's a relationship where they both equally kind of, like, suffered for the other one in a way, like, we know that Rory waited 2,000 years for her. This doesn't feel like it's just Amy constantly being asked to prove herself over and over. So I think in that sense, it doesn't feel like any sort of icky, weird, sexist undertones at all. I buy it as an example of this specific relationship.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that this era doesn't get as much credit for. And I think part of the reason is this era threw away a lot of its goodwill with how they used Amy and Rory in the Silence arc. But they do put a ton of work in developing this relationship over the course of 2.5 seasons. And I agree with you that it feels very strong. And I think one scene that I do want to highlight here, which I think ties into this very directly, and I think you were mentioning it just now, but I want to just get it out, tease it out a little more, because I think it's one of the best scenes of the episode, one of the season, frankly, is the two Amys talking to each other and just reminiscing about Rory and just about everything. And just, again, just how Karen Gillan lets the older Amy sort of warm up incrementally over the course of the conversation, and they're just remembering Rory as this guy who, like, came in with this terrible rocker haircut and then had to learn how to play guitar to cover for it. It's just such a lovely window into the pre-doctor. Well, I guess there's no such thing as a pre-doctor life for Amy, as we know from 11th Hour, but you know what I mean? Like what they were before the TARDIS showed back up again.
And there's that really lovely quote about Rory being the most beautiful man that she's met, and kind of how beauty is not just, you know, how you physically look, but when you're persona, your personality, your spirit kind of influences how you see someone. And I think that that's a really lovely sentiment, specifically for the characters of Amy and Rory, but also just, like, it's a beautiful statement on humanity. I think it's a very kind of adult and mature episode, which is what we were saying about School Reunion last week, that sometimes these character heavy episodes can really handle this topic with more maturity than I give Doctor Who credit for.
Yeah, and I think that to me is the one thing that remains really cool about the Amy and Rory relationship, that because the other relationships we tend to see on the show, I mean, to be honest, they tend to be the doctor and a companion, is the sort of quasi-romantic relationship throughout the RTD era. They always, because they can't really commit to it being a proper loving relationship, it's always in the initial stages of a relationship. Yeah. It's always, it's beyond the initial puppy love stage, but it isn't, I don't think it can ever be a terribly mature relationship, because it's not, they never define what the relationship's going to be. I like that Amy and Rory, they are much further. I mean, they're married, for goodness sake. Like, they are much further along in their relationship. And I think you're right that there is an adult sensibility, in the best sense of the word adult, not adult in the sense of, oh, they screw or whatever. But, like, you know, it's just a very mature understanding of what a relationship can be. And I think it's very nicely done here. And I think you're right. And I love that it's the younger Amy who makes the point about, you know, how, as you say, like, Rory, you know, she's clear as Rory was not the most gorgeous man in the world, but, like, he became that over time or whatever. Like, I think it's just, it's very nicely done, and it's nice to see the maturity from both the younger and the older Amy's here, and to treat her like an adult, especially when, as the next episode is really going to underline, the doctor can't help but see Amy as a little girl at all times. So, you know, the fact that the doctor is separated from them lets Amy and Rory be adults in this episode in a way that they're not always able to be so in other Doctor Who episodes.
Yeah, I was going to say it's episodes like this one that always get me more frustrated with their sort of breakup in Asylum of the Daleks. And then their fight where we learn that it was over them not being able to have kids. Amy decided she was just going to up and leave him so he could marry someone else. And it's like, come on, Amy, you are all ready to make it work with two versions of yourself. Like, maybe just have a conversation about adoption instead of just divorcing him. And so I think that this is such a stronger example of their relationship than, again, we maybe get elsewhere. But I think overall, the show actually did a really, really nice job with Amy and Rory.
Yeah, I mean, an Asylum of the Daleks, I think, is one of those things where we can, again, make a comparison with Kill the Moon, where I think – because you're a fan of the actual Amy and Rory hatching it out scene.
Yeah, but I love their performance.
But them getting there makes no sense whatsoever. Yeah. And I think it's similar to like Clara and the Doctor scene at the end of Kill the Moon is so beautiful and so essential and so important to the show. But the road there is insane and doesn't necessarily hold up to a lot of scrutiny. Because I would agree, like it's so hard to watch The Girl Who Waited and imagine that those two are not going to be together forever, or that's not quite right because relationships end, and that's not, you know, some sort of statement on the prior success of the relationship. It's just, you know, things grow apart. But as you say, for such an arbitrary, poorly thought out reason in Asylum of the Daleks, the couple that we see in The Girl Who Waited deserved a better reason to divorce than what they ultimately got in Asylum of the Daleks.
It's a really good point. Well, do you have any closing thoughts, or should we move on to setting up our debate for next week?
I will point out a little bit of trivia question here. Boomtown features the very first appearance of an actor from Classic Who. The guy who gets killed right at the very beginning of the episode had appeared in a Sylvester McCoy story. So there you go. A little bit. And obviously, I think the next one, or one of the big next ones, would of course be Elizabeth Sladen and John Leeson returning for School Reunion, which we discussed last week. But that was the very start of it. And there's some very nice things in the Doctor Who extra for Kill the Moon, highlighting that Tony Asoba, who is Duke, the older astronaut in Kill the Moon, that this is his third appearance on the show. And there's a great clip of his appearance in Destiny of the Daleks, a Tom Baker episode, where he is dressed again in the most aggressively, ridiculously 70s outfit imaginable, as an android warrior.
I watched that as well. It was very charming. He seemed very excited to be back. My closing thought is that I think both Karen Gillan and Arthur Darvill pull off those glasses really, really well. They both look quite dashing in them.
This is just a very, I will say this, this is a very good-looking episode of Doctor Who, Girl Who Waited, on really all parameters. And actually, you know, the other thing I just want to say quickly about Boomtown, it is the one episode where Jack is just kind of a companion, and I will admit, it's fun.
Yeah, agreed, and really good styling on his jacket. It, like, called back to his 1940s look, but he also was modern.
And the scarf that he takes off to reveal, like, the blue shirt. Mm-hmm. It's a very John Barrowman is dressed very nicely in that episode. And it's one of those interesting things where, again, there are very few attempts to write a companion who is the theoretical equal of the Doctor, because it kind of defeats the purpose of the companion if they know everything the Doctor knows. But I actually thought, as the secondary companion, it's really cool to have a guy who responds, who knows a lot of the same things the Doctor knows, but responds to it in a really different way. And I'm always a little bummed, actually, that Boomtown kind of loses track of Jack in the second half of the episode.
Yeah.
I think I would love to if they could have found something else to do, because I will admit I love when he, the Doctor, and Margaret are in the TARDIS together, and there's just the little lines like, you know, don't talk to her, that's what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when the Doctor is looking at Mickey and Rose walking away on the view screen, he says, anything good on? And it's just like he's clearly saying, come on, Doctor, you're better than this. Don't spy on Rose.
He's a really nice addition there. And Barrowman, he's not quite in his overplaying Jack phase that I feel like maybe he gets to later.
It's
definitely
does.
One of the most naturalistic performances that we see from him.
Well,
I can't believe I forgot. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think the thing about John Barrowman, I really enjoy him as an actor. I'm really glad that he's on Arrow, a show I review for the AV Club that is starting this week. Just a little plug. He's a very fun actor, but I think he's not really a series lead. And putting him on Torchwood and asking him to be like the tortured series lead of a sci-fi show was asking. I think it just kind of pushed Jack into a weird area where he never came back from. And I think series one Jack remains by far the most fun version of Jack. Where I think you're right. There's just a better balance here between well, the captain of the innuendo squad and the sort of, you know, but the actual, like, serious, you know, time agent as well. There's a nice balance here, and it's on nice display in Boomtown.
I was going to say, I can't believe I forgot to mention this. My real biggest complaint of The Girl Who Waited is that they should have dyed Karen Gillan's hair gray. It would have looked so cool, and it would have been such a cool way to even further distinguish the two Amys. And if she's in her 60s, like, she's at least going to have some gray hairs by then.
It's possible. You know, I know that not everyone grays, but yeah, you're right that, well, she's in her late 50s if she's been there 36 years.
Well, depending on how old she is now.
I feel like they cheat how old Amy is supposed to be. I feel like if you do the math, she's supposed to be very early 20s, but I will admit that the math and logic really suggest she should be like more like mid-20s. But either way, your point is well taken. I imagine it may have just been if you dye Karen Gillan's hair one way, you're kind of committed to it. So I think it may have just been
just get that spray in,
get the spray
stuff
on,
for
yeah.
Halloween, a little spray and gray streaks.
I feel like we would not be praising the visuals of The Girl Who Waited if they were still using the spray on Halloween gray hair effect. But I will take your point that I'm glad we've got it down to that being your biggest issue with The Girl Who Waited. I think that's
come a long way.
Fantastic progress, and I'm very happy with that.
All right. Well, why don't you set us up for what we're going to be chatting about next week?
Well, next week is in the actual ongoing series is The Mummy on the Orient, or Mummy on the Orient Express. I don't believe there's a definite article to start. It's written by Jamie Matheson, another new addition to the writing team this year. So he'll be writing actually both of the next two episodes. So that'll be interesting to see some new blood. And I don't necessarily know we know a ton about this episode. We don't even know whether Clara is in it. Indeed, there's a good indication that she's not going to be in it, which I think is going to be very interesting to see how that shakes out. But we know that this is Orient Express in space, which is sort of a callback to the end of The Big Bang, if people remember that final phone call the Doctor has. So it's one of those things where I think we've kind of been told two big things about this episode, that it looks like it's going to be this crazy romp in outer space. But we've been told it's not a romp. It's super dark. So I wanted to look at a pair of episodes that are romps in outer space that take dark and, frankly, somewhat strange turns, and also feature the Doctor in some somewhat unusual companion configurations. So we're going to be looking at the 10th Doctor's third Christmas special, Voyage of the Damned, and the 11th Doctor, Amy, Rory and Brian Williams episode, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
I am so happy you picked Voyage of the Damned, because I feel like it's going to be so fun to talk about, and I was really hoping that would be one of the choices for this week.
I'm
also Dinosaurs on a Spaceship is fun.
Yeah, that's a fun one as well, but I think I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of parallels to draw between Voyage of the Damned and Mummy on the Orient Express. Mm-hmm. If it's anything like what I think it's going to be, and also first appearance of Wilf. If nothing else about that episode, we get our first taste of the Wilf. Oh, Wilf and Brian, actually, next week. So the adorable older men of Doctor Who are going to be out in force next week.
And if you'll recall, based on the titles alone, Mummy on the Orient Express was the episode I was most looking forward to. So we'll see if those hopes are dashed or based in something when it happens next week.
All right. So next week, as we say, Mummy on the Orient Express, Voyage of the Damned, and Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. Man, that's the goofiest collection of titles I think we've had for any
really
podcast.
Is.
I'm super excited. Caroline, you want to give the standard assortment of plugs to finish us off?
As always, debatingdoctorwho@gmail.com. We've been a little slow on email, so now is your chance to sneak in there and win the Danielle fan email of the week. @debatingdw on Twitter. We love to hear your tweets. Or read them, rather, because you can't hear tweets. And then debatingdoctorwho.tumblr.com. Those are all the places you can find us. As always, we love hearing from you. Until next week, bye!
See ya!